So before, or maybe instead of my giving my talk, perhaps we can have a little bit of discussion about how that exercise was for some of you. Did you find it interesting, and what happened, and what did you learn? Yes?
It seems like every time I was looking at a body part that was comforted, I noticed it was comforted because it didn't hurt right that time. So it was like going through a process of elimination, right? Something that was regularly comfortable, not always ecstatic, and not always hurting. So it took a while.
Uh-huh. When you feel, there must be times in your life where you felt really peaceful. That happened to you?
Oh, yeah.
So when you feel that peacefulness, is there a physical sensation that's associated with that?
Yes, dead tired.
Have you ever been peaceful without being dead tired?
No.
No?
So that comes after doing something I like doing that's very active and wearing myself out doing it. Uh-huh. And afterwards it's peaceful.
Uh-huh.
It's fun up there, then it's peaceful.
Okay, thank you. Yes?
I found that the place that I found that was peaceful when you mentioned fear, I found fear existed right beside it.
And what, if any, do you think the relationship is between the two? Yes?
Actually, that touches something off for me. I mean, I found the same thing, that they were in identical locations, sort of small of the, well, below the small of the back, in the back and the belly. And perhaps it's just because it's so core that it manages to incorporate the deepest extremes.
Maybe so. A nice observation. Yes?
I was actually surprised that the place was the same place where I've been having a lot of physical pain recently. And it was very peaceful there.
Did any of you notice if there were some tendencies you have, some demons perhaps, that are that feed or supported or stimulated by your fear? Yes?
All of them. When I followed your instructions and thought about how the fear of that particular thing might be caught up in judgment or desire or whatever, yes, it was the fear that caused my judgments and caused my desires and caused all of those things.
Great. Thank you.
For me, the fear was the demon.
Does it feed itself? So her fear feeds her fear. Where? Did I see a head?
What?
Someone here has a hand up?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say I had it in the same place also, but that when I was feeling peaceful, it was very different because it was very open. And when I started thinking about fear, that same place, but it was all contracted and tight. And it was very hard to get the peace back at the end. Very difficult to open it again.
I can well imagine. Thank you. Yes?
I found that it was kind of a reminder for me, because it used to be easier for me to pull myself away from my fears or anxieties into a place of peace. And it's been harder and harder as of late, so it was good to kind of go back to it and find it. For me, it was, you know, I thought at first, oh, maybe it's my stomach, but I thought, no, you know, I'm usually feeling sick to my stomach about so many things. And then went to my heart, and it was very peaceful, but all around me there felt to be a lot of pain. But but I learned quite a while ago to pull away, to kind of, if I was at one extreme, to try to pull myself back to the other, to balance myself out. And I learned as a way.
Thank you. Yes, Elaine.
Yeah, my greatest fear were having to do with losses, losing material possessions, losing friends or family, or losing health. And of course, what that fear feeds is acquisition and clinging. And that turned out to be just the definition of who I am. It's a horrible thought that my whole life is around avoiding losses. And I don't know that I'm so dedicated to acquisitions, but certainly there's a heck of a lot of clinging that goes on as a result of that fear.
May you,
discouraging kind of a thing to notice.
May you find another part of yourself so that you don't have to say that it's my whole life or all of me. It's only a part. Yes?
I noticed that the thing I was most afraid of was anxiety itself. The fear was feeding the anxiety, but at the same time, the thing I was most afraid of. Kind of paradox.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Marty?
Fear is associated. Sort of self-preoccupation and centeredness, self-centeredness, and the withdrawal from others.
Withdrawal from others?
Withdrawal from others into myself. Self becomes more real at the time of fear. I don't know that one causes the other. I mean, they're linked in the conflict.
I think very much so, and I think Elaine's statement points to that also, that for many of us, our concepts of self are defined by our fears more than almost anything else, either directly or indirectly. Yes?
I was thinking, when you said to identify the demon, I was thinking that thing, demon, for me, is also the thing that I think has brought me here, which, you know, that it sort of pushed me toward the thing of growth, to wanting to grow. Uh-huh. But it's that, it's like it can't ever stop. It's too much in my head. You know, this thing of, like, there's no surcease from, it's like constant running. So.
Thank you. In East Asian Buddhism, they have a ceremony called Segaki. And Segaki is a ceremony of feeding the hungry ghosts. And in America, usually in Japan, it usually happens in August. But in America, it seems so conveniently so well associated with Halloween that some of the Zen centers in this area, they do this ceremony at Halloween rather than in August. And it's a ceremony of various things, but one of the ways of understanding it is a ceremony of acknowledging the unseen and unacknowledged aspects of life or aspects of ourselves. And I think a very important part of a mindfulness practice is finding some way to acknowledge those parts of ourselves which tend to be unacknowledged or unrecognized. And there are, of course, there are a lot more that gets unacknowledged and unrecognized than fear. But fear is often the cause or the reason why we shut off or shut down or numb out around certain things so we don't acknowledge it. So the idea of a ceremony that somehow encourages us to kind of draw this part out then is a beautiful thing, I think, to take a time to kind of actively look at it. And in a sense, perhaps that's what Halloween is about in our culture. It's a time for letting the demons come out, the alter egos or whatever, and acting them out, or letting us get afraid, or letting it all come in a way that is not so usually we do in our society. We don't usually act out these kind of different parts of ourselves. And Halloween gives some of us kind of a freedom to act out parts of us that are usually unacknowledged or unexpressed in a full way. And what's interesting to me is how much Halloween has become domesticated over the years, and I don't know for how long. And my understanding is back in England or Scotland or Ireland or whatever Halloween came from, it wasn't so domesticated. This Halloween, the evening before All Saints' Day. It was really a time for when the spirits, the hungry ghosts, the unacknowledged parts came and visiting, and people were often quite afraid, and they'd have bonfires to kind of, I think bonfires are partly to make them safe or to chase them away or invite them, or I'm not sure what. But bonfires. And one of the things I like about the origins of Halloween is that it is the evening before All Saints' Day, which seems like, you know, it should be a very holy, special, sacred day. And that the two kind of go together, that this day of allowing for the unseen, the unacknowledged, the frightening parts of life, the hungry ghosts, to allow them to come in and acknowledge them, goes together with the next day where the saintly or the pure or the peaceful or whatever way you want to call it are acknowledged and celebrated. And what we have in our culture is we celebrate Halloween only half the equation, half the picture. And it's been domesticated, you know, for the most part. I mean, it's, you know, the full kind of acknowledgement of our real demons in a way that really kind of confronts us with our deepest fears. You know, it usually doesn't happen so much at Halloween as maybe it could if we had, you know, a different kind of ritual or a different kind of ceremony. But to find some way to acknowledge our full humanity, I think, is also really key to the mindfulness practice itself. And it's especially important, I feel, as any community, whether it's a small meditation community like this or as it's a bigger Buddhist community, as it becomes a community, communities always have a kind of culture or a kind of mindset or whatever. And cultures always have shadows, always have parts which are kind of accepted and not accepted. And a traditional one in Buddhism is, one of them is, that's not accepted so well, is anger. Because Buddhism has this wonderful ideals of kindness and compassion. And when you have that as an ideal, the ideal sometimes will mask or cover up or things like anger, because if you're a good Buddhist, you're supposed to be kind. And if you're angry, you're not being kind. So if you want to be a good Buddhist in a Buddhist community, you better not show your anger. And that creates a tremendous shadow and a very dangerous one for all Buddhist communities, I think. And it's part of, you know, every culture has a shadow. It's kind of a natural part. It's kind of maybe appropriate part of culture to have this kind of, to emphasize something and something else gets de-emphasized. But then it's a function of a Buddhist practice in opposition or kind of in contrast to a Buddhist culture to really draw out that part or to acknowledge or find some way to recognize that part of us which has been put into the shadow, which has been ignored or been pushed away or not deemed appropriate, and so we're not going to look at it. And we need to have both, kind of a balance each other. We need to have a strong practice if the community is going to be healthy, because the practice reveals the places where the community gets stuck or the community is blind. But it's very hard. But if you don't have the culture, it's very hard to kind of practice alone. And the culture, the community creates a context and a holder for the practice to really occur in a healthy way or in a full way. But you need to have both going back and forth, the practice and the community and the practice. So Buddhism focuses on, well, in becoming kind of fully acknowledged, all aspects of us, it's important not to see it only as being the fears and our demons, the difficult parts, but that the unacknowledged parts are often can be anything, including the beautiful parts of ourselves, the pure parts and the peaceful parts. Some people will spend the whole day being quite frantic or running around being quite busy and never taking the time to recognize or touch in with that which is peaceful within them. And some of you might have found that doing a little exercise of finding the place of peace within you, a place in the body that's associated with it, surprised you how easy it was to get in touch with it. Some of you, maybe it wasn't that the case. But sometimes it can be quite easy, but when your life is really busy running around, not only all day, but all week, and all month, and all year, and all lifetime, there's often, sometimes not a chance to recognize or settle back in some part of us which is more peaceful and more at ease. So the mindfulness practice is a practice which is designed to help us kind of fill in the mandala, to fill in all the pieces that haven't been really fully been acknowledged or seen in the field of awareness. So one of the things that we talk about in Buddhism or recognize as one of the places that's often unacknowledged is something that's called hungry ghosts. And maybe many of you have heard of this before. But hungry ghosts are these very interesting beings that Buddhism has dreamed up that have a very big bellies and very big mouths and incredibly thin throats. And they have this tremendous desire to, longing or wish, craving, to satisfy this hungry stomach, which is so big. But you can only get so much down, so little down that thin throat at a time. So it can never get enough to satisfy this big stomach. So it's always craving and wanting more and more and more. And a hungry ghost is that which is never fulfilled, but always kind of wanting to be filled and, you know, wanting more and more and more. And it's said in Buddhism that the cause for becoming a hungry ghost is in a past lifetime, a person was constantly consuming whatever, consuming goods, consuming relationships, consuming spiritual states even, just very greedy for all kinds of things and always getting more and more and more. And then the result is in the next lifetime, next birth, they get reborn as a hungry ghost, and they're doomed to never be satisfied and just feel the endless longing of always longing for something. And part of the longing is always to long for something outside of oneself. Something else is going to provide the fulfillment. Some relationship, some activity, some spiritual practice, some financial position, some whatever. And always looking outside, and it can never be enough. Even if you get a little bit, or you get enough, you know, satisfactory amount of money, you always want more and more and more. You can never quite get enough and rest in yourself. And so this hungry ghost is one of the primary things which is acknowledged in this Sagaki ceremony, the ceremony that happens around Halloween. We all have our hungry ghosts within us. And so this is a time to see, you know, check in and notice, what is my hungry ghost? What is it that is unfulfilled within me, which is feeding this tremendous craving and desire for more and more and more? I'll read a poem, which maybe I've read many times before. And it's kind of perhaps a description of maybe how hungry ghosts work or how our fears and cravings feed further things if they're unacknowledged, not taken care of properly. So Kabir writes, "Friend, please tell me what I can do about this world I hold on to and keep spinning out. I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day the cloth was well woven. So I bought some burlap, but but I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pulled back my sexual longings, and now I discover that I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice that I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I'm proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it still holds on to something. Kabir says, "Listen, my friend, there are very few that find the path." So spiritual practice also can kind of be a kind of trap. And, you know, there's this idea of, you know, we have to... that some part of ourselves is unacceptable. Some part of ourselves needs to be reined in and held back and held in check. And the way of mindfulness is not to hold anything back, not to check anything, but rather to let whatever is our movements within us to bubble up, not so much in action, not so much that we then act on every impulse, but rather to let all the impulses within us bubble up into the field of knowing, into the field of awareness, into the field of awakening. And to discover how to hold these things, how to allow them, how to allow ourselves to be as we are, without shutting any part off, but allowing it to bubble up and just letting it be there, and without even maybe taking it personally. To allow the fear to be there, to allow the wanting and the demons to be there, without necessarily taking them as being personal, seeing just, oh, this is what's here. And you might ask, why is this important? Why is this useful? The whole premise of awakening in Buddhism, and I was accused today of not talking about awakening enough in his talks. So the whole premise of awakening in Buddhism is based on the simple human phenomena, very simple, incredibly simple, that there's a difference between having an experience and knowing you're having it. The difference between, for example, thinking and knowing you're thinking. The difference between having fear and know that you're having fear. The difference between being angry and knowing you're angry. The difference between being filled with joy and knowing that you're filled with joy. The ability to know is really the precious area that opens to the world of awakening in Buddhism. Because that ability to know represents our ability not to be entangled with whatever's going on. The knowing itself is a very, very simple phenomena. It doesn't judge, it doesn't criticize, it doesn't hold on, it doesn't want it to be different, it doesn't push away. It simply allows something to rise and be there by itself. And so the greater degree we can settle back and simply rest in the knowing of experience and let that knowing become stronger, to that degree, awakening gets born within us. But as soon as we shut something down and close something down, saying this is not acceptable to my knowing, then knowing is also shut down, and the world of awakening is kept at a distance from us. But knowing is such an incredibly simple phenomena that most of us don't believe that it's worth anything. So we'd rather hold on to things and try to adjust things and try to reach out for things and get things and protect ourselves from things. But really, the principle of mindfulness is to rest there in that knowing so that all aspects of ourselves can bubble up and then we can act wisely in the world. So that's my Halloween talk for 1997. So what are your thoughts? Yes.
One of the ways to express our demons in Halloween is a big candy to children. This is very bad.
You think so? For kids? Maybe that's the secret to demons, is to feed them nicely. Not with our fear, but with our kindness. So these kids come and they're dressed up as demons, and we adults meet them with our kindness and our generosity. What a great thing. Yes.
I know I asked this before, but I can't remember what you said. Is the mind a hungry ghost?
And what I said last time is, it's one of the masks it puts on. It's one of the costumes it puts on. And the mind puts on many costumes in its life. But the mind is not a hungry ghost, because the essence of the mind is not a hungry ghost. But rather, it's one of the aspects, one of the costumes it puts on. And then we're fooled by it, and we live through it. And there's other costumes it can put on also. In the Buddhism, there's these six realms of existence, which somehow describes the six costumes that the mind could put on. And one of the costumes is the hungry ghost costume. Another is the wrathful deities.
That was
your favorite? Wrathful deities. And one of them is the animal costume. And animals are symbolic or represent confused states. So you can put on a confused mask costume. And then there's the hell mask or the hell costume. And that's when we're, you know, suffering unbearably, with lots and lots of suffering. And then there's also the heavenly costume, deva costumes. We dress ourselves up as gods, and we're full of joy and delight and happiness, and everything's going really great. And then the sixth costume is the human costume. And with all that, all that comes with being human. But what's special about the human costume is the human costume is it's in the human costume that there's the ability to know things. In this kind of way, clearly knowing things in a non-judgmental, clear way. And so it's said in Buddhism, it's only with the human costume that a person can become liberated. Because it's only when you have the ability to know clearly and see clearly that you can actually allow the analogy I used on Thursday, the classic one in Buddhism, metaphor, is that of the lotus growing out of the muddy water. And awakening in Buddhism is described as a lotus growing out of muddy water. And when the lotus grows out of the muddy water, it's completely white. It's unstained by the muddy water. And the lotus that's going to sprout is the lotus of knowing. When the knowing becomes free and independent, unconditioned by anything, then we have this awakening in the midst of the muddy waters. But the other costumes, the hungry ghost and the wrathful deities and the animals and the hell realms, and also the deity realms. And when you have those costumes on, the tendency is to be so caught up in those costumes to not allow the knowing to really clearly see and be mindful of what's going on. It's very hard to be mindful when you're caught up in something, entangled. So it said that the only realm, the only costume that really works to become free is the human costume, because that's where we can clearly know what's going on. So choose your costumes carefully.
Well, I don't understand. I thought you were saying that the mind has these different costumes.
Sure.
And that being human is mind?
Sure.
The mind chooses to be human?
Sure.
I don't understand.
Well, it's a metaphorical way of talking. When you're... When we're lost in rage, and completely preoccupied in our rage, and kind of lost in it, then we're really lost in the realm of the wrathful deities. When we're lost in our desire, and we can never get enough, then we're lost in the realm of what's called the hungry ghosts. But when we can really clearly know and see, be very clearly mindful, that's called the human realm.
Aren't we lost in humans?
These are all descriptions of being human. I mean, as human beings, you have to kind of not take it too literally, all this. Okay.
It seems to break down there at the end. As far as being parallel constructions, so, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's okay, but you know, I'm trying.
Make it up, right? It's not your fault.
Well, it's partly my fault. Buddhism has a cosmology for describing all the different realms of rebirth that a being can be reborn in. And these are the six realms of rebirth, possibly rebirth. A person can be reborn as a hungry ghost, and they're kind of like this, like a ghost floating around. They can be reborn as deities. They can be reborn as animals, which, you know, like there's animals all around us, right? So that's a certain kind of rebirth. And you can be reborn in hell. And you can be reborn as a human being. And one way of understanding this cosmology, these are very real, you know, metaphysical entities. They're really ghosts, and they're really our wrathful deities and real deities up there in heaven, and there's heavens and there's hells and all that. That's one way of understanding it. Another way of understanding it, which there's a tradition in Buddhism of understanding it this way, is seeing as all being metaphor for different states of mind. So they're not talking at all about external reality, but they're talking about different states of mind that we can kind of visit or be in. And so sometimes we're in a state of mind that's filled with anger, and sometimes filled with desire, and sometimes filled with joy. And when we're entangled in that, then in this kind of metaphoric way of talking, then we've entered into that realm and we're not longer in the human realm. And the definition of the human realm, or the human kind of state, what's special about being a human being that's different from the other, is our ability to clearly be mindful in the present moment. So I called it then, it's the human costume.
So you didn't make it.
You know, I said this earlier this year, but there's a saying, all wisdom is plagiarism. Only foolishness is original. So, you'll forgive me, yes?
You were briefly you spoke about all these concepts in relationship to various communities. You were talking about the Buddhist community. So it just came into my mind about our country being very consumer-focused as one big thing, and also sort of militaristic or defensive in terms of building up some chains. Just wondering what thoughts you might have on what fears might be feeding those societal demons of ours, if it fits to put the question in that
way. I suppose. I mean, I don't really feel like I'm qualified to kind of analyze American society and kind of say, you know, this is where the fears are. But I mean, I think, yeah, there's at different times there are different hungry ghosts and different fears and different wrathful deities that seem to be kind of washed across great segments of our society. And then there's kind of, you know, I was hearing on the radio today that this is the 50th anniversary of an American committee kind of blacklisting people in Hollywood, you know, film producers and writers and all that. And you know, 50 years ago there was this wave of fear and anger and animosity that swept big parts of this country, not all of it. And I know people who were who were fired from their jobs and couldn't find work. There's Lou Hartman. Remember Lou Hartman who talked to me maybe a year ago here? Mm-hmm. Older man, Zen priest.
Yeah.
He was a... I don't know if he was called before the Congress because he was one of those people blacklisted. And when he came back, he couldn't get a job anywhere. He was in radio. He was a radio broadcaster in San Francisco, somewhat well known. And he couldn't find work, and he'd come back and he'd take kind of day jobs, on construction jobs, you know, carpentry jobs, building homes and stuff. And he'd have a job for a day or so, and then the FBI would roll up in their nice little cars and have a little talk with the foreman of the construction site, and the next thing you know, he'd be fired. So that's a kind of demon. You know, what the sources of it is, I don't know, but you know, these things well worth reflecting on. When you started your questioning, My mind went slightly differently, and that was at some point, I don't know if maybe it's you know, we're big enough now, but at some point we should actually have a discussion about what our own hungry ghosts are as a community, what our own shadow sides are, and try to put them out. You know, certainly at some point when we get bigger, I think it's just worthwhile just to kind of ask each other, kind of be very, very frank about it. What are we afraid of? What are we afraid of? What are the hungry ghosts? What are the demons? What are the shadow sides of our community as our community becomes more organized? I think having them stated publicly or acknowledged publicly is a very important process. Yes?
This is more an answer to your question, Zoe. There's a movie that was just made recently by I don't know whether it was by KQED, but it was on KQED, called Afluenza, and maybe some of you saw it. I felt that was really the demon of American society right now, affluenza being the disease of affluence and the desire for goods. And I just really highly recommend it, because no matter how frugal you may think you are, no matter how you think you might have simplified your life and done that demon in, that movie will get to you in some spot that you neglected, and you will know and understand it much more clearly. I certainly did, and I certainly understood it much more clearly the second time I saw it with my class, and they were certainly not affluent, and yet it all affected them very strongly. So I think that's our disease, or one of them. Most important ones.
I heard that the stock market fell today. How many of you were bummed? Yes.
Seems like one of the conflicts of being human is this desire for direct experience, feeling things kind of raw and unfiltered, kind of like being without a skin or something, really wanting that direct perception or fusion, and noticing that's kind of uncomfortable, and so putting clothes on or costumes like this affluenza, wanting some kind of protection from direct experience, beliefs, or clothes, or things. It seems that there are these choices between how good it feels to know things directly and how impossible that immediacy, how disorienting maybe that that kind of experience can be. And in this society, it seems like there are a lot of alternatives to direct experience. And I feel that conflict.
I think you point to a very important conflict in our society, or tension. And that is that there's in the affluenza and the desire, there's so many opportunities to do things and so many activities and so many acquisitions and so many wonderful things, recreational activities and television and movies and all this stuff to stimulate us, that in some ways if we do too many of these things, which there's kind of a tendency sometimes to do, it actually alienates ourselves from ourselves and from the world around us. And then that alienated state produces a hungry ghost that actually craves for more contact, more real contact. And then it's confused. The desire for more real contact is confused by trying to do more, get more of the stuff that society is promising you will do it for you. And there can be a vicious cycle of trying to get this kind of real intimate contact with life, and being confused by trying to get more and more activities to fill yourself with. And it can be a terrible cycle. And I think part of the function of a spiritual practice is to break that cycle, so that you're no longer swinging between the pendulum of craving direct experience or direct intimacy, but also not trying to fill some kind of empty need by doing all kinds of stuff that actually keeps us separate. But we should stop. I think it's getting late. And if you want to talk to me, you can, you know, come up afterwards. But it's important to get lots of rest. Thank you.